speak into the mic?
Yeah, I'll turn it on in a second. Okay. It's a very good microphone. It picks up very nice. Okay. So I think if I sit it here, right, that'll fine. Be fine. I have a list of questions. There's quite a few, so we'll see how I go. If you don't feel like you want to answer something, that's fine. We'll just go on to the next one.
I have not.
And if you want to have a break at any time, you can stop as well. This is an interview with His Holiness Srila Maharaj for the ISKCON Oral History Project on 30th of October 2003 at Bhaktivedanta Lab. So first I'll just start with some more basic questions. Can you tell me what your legal name is?
John Coltlu.
Okay. How do I spell that?
Same way you would any other English call clue. Well, there's E-U-G-H and there's O-U-G-H.
Uh-huh.
But we're E's.
Okay. I just need to write it down.
C-O-L-C-L-E-U-G-H.
Okay. And when and where were you born?
I was born in Vancouver, St. Paul's Hospital. At 2:50 daylight savings time in the morning, 1948.
Okay. And could you tell me, just briefly describe what your life was like before
I was hellish in the womb. Got bitten and it was very dirty and everything, so I decided to come out.
Mm-hmm.
let's see, I was the first son. My father had just gotten back from the Second World War and he was an orphan. In his life. Anyway, he was very intelligent, got a scholarship, and he did his master's degree in social work. My mother was an RN.
Registered nurse.
Registered nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, her mother was from a small town in Ireland. And her parents were married in London. Her father was also Irish. He was Scottish background. So her parents came over. And she was born in Yukon Territory in Fort St. John, and she was raised in a Catholic school. Her mother was very Catholic, and you know, one of those places that you hear about where someone rode their bicycle to school in the snow,
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but she was not very religious per se. Her mother was not so much of a church goer, but I guess she was devout in her conviction, her Catholic conviction. Grandfather was not very, my grandfather was not so religious. The first years of my life, I guess, I didn't have much association with my parents, because my mother was working. So I was mostly with my grandmother, who lived in Vancouver at the time. And uh, I don't remember a whole lot from those days. A few things, but I went to school. I remember something about my teenage life was I think it was difficult because I was very shy and at the same time very sensitive, and I always had one part of my father's personality, and I think since I came out of the womb I couldn't stop cracking jokes. So even in school I remember I used to make all the other students in the class laugh. Somehow I pulled through school. But my teenage life was very rough. And I had, my father was a military. He was in the reserves. And he was in charge of a regiment, a tank corps. So I didn't join the Boy Scouts, I was in the cadets. And in summer I went to cadet camp. So it was quite a disciplined life in one sense. I wanted to. We lived in a kind of upper middle class neighborhood, and I went to an upper class school. Everybody was a little rich kid except for us, or people in our strata. And they segregated classes. So there was an academic class, an advanced class, and I was always in that class, and my teachers were always slightly disturbed that I wasn't applying myself because they felt I should have been exceptional. But I was always, I don't know, bored, whatever. I was always getting into mischief, and I was always getting the strap in school, and the strap over the hand in the principal's office. So if I got it in school, I got it at home also. So somehow or other, I just never developed strong affection for home life. And my father, being an orphan, didn't know how to express his emotions. He worked hard for the children, but he couldn't communicate. He never said, "I love you," or anything like that. So there was always some kind of estrangement between he and myself, especially because I was number one and I was expected to be perfect. He even went to the point where he threatened, he claims he didn't, but I remember it, that he mentioned to me that he could have me taken to the police and declared incorrigible, and they would take me away and whatever. So that was something of our relationship. On the other side, he got me involved in sports, which saved my life, I think. Football, English, American football, soccer, baseball, little hockey, cross-country running, wrestling, chess, I was a very good chess player. These things saved me somehow or other. I took French and Latin in school, although they were electives. I didn't decide, he decided. But at the same time, it gave me a good foundation in English. And English was always one of my better subjects. Math and English. When I went to university, then I was on my own. At first I lived at home and commuted every day to the University of British Columbia, an engineering school. Then later on I lived outside, and I slowly drifted away from the family, and I guess I missed something. I haven't looked at it very deeply, but I guess I missed something in the family that I was still looking for. And I tried to find it in various communities, or at that time known as communes. And still I could see through. I didn't have a lot of intimate friends. I was friendly with everyone, but I only had one or two people that I was close to. And I saw that there was a lot of hypocrisy even in such communes. But I was just searching. So at that time, from about 18 to 20, 18 and a half, after my first year of university, I just dropped out.
What amazing. What year was that, by the way?
It was 66 or 67, I can't remember.
That was your first year of university?
Yeah, I was 17. So
you dropped out?
Yeah, I was bored to death. I didn't go to classes. I was just bored. They couldn't teach me what I needed. I wanted to know more about life, and they were trying to make me into an engineer, which should have been no problem with my SAT scores. And, recently I tested my IQ, and it was 134 with a mathematical visual orientation. 134 is not low.
The class is very gifted, I think. Gifted is up to 130.
Yeah, it's 135 is genius, so 134 is near genius. And they were always telling me that, why my math, I should have. So, Ramanuja. Too late, telling them I'm busy in the RL. Hari Bhav. Hare Krishna. Please accept my blessings. Blessed to Prabhupada. A couple of days ago. No, I was just... my health has not been too good. And I was survive. Nothing. I just... a lot of cramps and suffering and different complications. They'll go away sometime. Or either they'll go away or I'll go away, one or the other. Well, let's see. It's not up to you or me, is it? I'm leaving tomorrow morning. Yeah. Okay, what time will you come? Oh, Okay, well, I'm going to Vishwambar's house. It's 5:30 or 6 for an hour. Yeah. Okay, I'll be back around 7 or so, 7:30. No, I'm fine. No, I'm leaving tomorrow morning on the flight, so I just want to try and sleep. Yeah. You could bring one of those telephone cards, maybe. Yeah. I could make some telephone. I'd like to call here. I saw me, actually. Okay. Hi, Nemo. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's okay. So you were saying that you were bored with the course and it wasn't teaching you what you wanted.
So
you dropped out.
Ended up with some unhappy hippies and big house. I was really searching by that time. And up until the time I was 18, I never took any drugs. And that was the time, the 60s, that's when we tune in, turn on, drop out. And if you didn't, you were L7.
L7?
L? Mm-hmm. 7. Square. There was a song, they call me L7. I think it was a British group. Anyway. So I started taking my 12-year-old brother introduced me to hashish, and it was more advanced than me. And then it went right from hash, marijuana, to acid and mescaline, and then finally ended up on with some bad people. I started, I was desperate because nothing satisfied me. It was either full of paranoia or just a fairy tale, an electric Kool-Aid acid trip, or a yellow submarine cartoon. And that wasn't what I had in mind as reality. So then I got into hard drugs, like methadone and mainlining, and finally heroin, and long, maybe 4 or 5 months. With my group, by that time, I ended up with a job. I was the only one working, so everybody else was on the dole, unemployment, whatever. So I was buying. Some were pharmaceutical salespersons selling drugs. You know that story?
No.
Someone asked Prabhupada, Prabhupada, can I become Krishna conscious? I used to sell drugs. And Prabhupada said, yes, I was in pharmaceuticals before.
Yeah, I think he said that to Shyama Sundar. He said, don't worry, I was also a drug dealer.
Anyway.
Yeah.
And the man. So I must have got my little dragon at that time. A few times I fooled around. Then I realized it was useless waste of time. The association was bad. And by that time I'd been down to San Francisco and I met the devotees. And
How did you meet the devotees?
Well, the first devotee I saw was in 68. And that was Hansa Duda traveling with a little traveling party across Canada, and he ended up in Vancouver in front of the library, the city library, chanting. And I think I was stoned, as they say, on something mescaline, whatever. And I just thought they were very beautiful. I thought maybe they were Buddhists or something. I had no idea. But from a distance. Then the next time I met devotees was in Berkeley on Telegraph Avenue. We had come down for the Altamont concert, which was the Rolling Stones' first tour of America. And they came to California, and that was a notorious concert. The Hells Angels were bouncers on the stage. I think they killed two people.
At that concert?
Yeah, when Mick Jagger sang Sympathy for the Devil. Poor Mick.
What year was that?
69. Right. So, after that I was staying in Berkeley. I was living just different places every night, like one of the six Goswamis, and my future occupation was being developed. And I was also panhandling or begging on the famous Telegraph Avenue. And there was quite a crowd there of students. Berkeley was one of the more famous campuses in the USA. I think so many Nobel laureates come out of there, and also a lot of, it's like the, I don't know if you can compare it exactly, but it's something like the, what's that school up north? Oxford, Cambridge, it's like the Cambridge of the West Coast, you know. A lot of radicals and a lot of brilliant people, but anyway, there were a lot of young people there from all over the States, not just studying, but there was, the hippie revolution was still happening. The devotees had a temple on Haight-Ashbury. So I met a devotee on Telegraph Avenue. His name was Babu Brahan, and he had a book table. Actually, it wasn't even a book table. It was selling incense and things, and there were some pamphlets. And he was passing out mantra cards also. So he had a big picture, big painting of Mahavishnu. It was one of Jadarani's, her earliest paintings, so I guess this was either a painting or a poster, I don't remember. So I saw that, and I said, "Who's that?" And he said, "That's God." So, being a bit of a cynic, I said, "Oh, what if I broke the picture?" And his Brooklyn accent, he said, "Well, I guess I'd have to kill you." So I thought, "Oh, okay." I walked away from there. But I got a mantra card inviting to a Sunday feast, which sounded very appealing under my circumstances, especially not eating much. So on Sunday I went over to the San Francisco temple, which was across the bay from Berkeley. He checked over there. And it's just on Haight Street, on Frederick Street, which ran parallel to Haight Street. It's just the other side of Haight Street, where all the famous hippie people lived and carried on their activities. So the first person I met at the door, sitting at a table demanding donations, was Jayananda. And I was early, so he made me give a donation for the feast, and then he invited me in and got me to vacuum the rug on the floor of the temple, which I did. And then I thought, okay, now I'll relax. But then he again grabbed me and got me rolling Simply Wonderfuls, and he showed me a technique how to do two at a time, one in each hand. And I guess he was pretty much my Vartma Pradarshika guru, in the sense that he was the first one to engage me in devotional service. It was always nice to be engaged by Jayananda because he was so transcendental, in that everybody who came within his aura felt his sublime qualities and presence. So I was so much attracted at that Sunday feast, the explosion of sensual experiences for the eyes, the ears, and then especially the tongue. And those devotees had no idea of the feasts which we made in those days. The Sunday feasts were, most temples were at least 12 preparations, and there were some that were as many as 18, 20 preparations. Gainesville, Florida Amarendra, his temple, the Sunday feast was famous because they had 20 preparations. And I remember in Los Angeles we started cooking on Monday for the Sunday feast, Malpura, things that would keep gulab jamun, rasgullas, everything was color coded, the plum chutney next to the white sweet camphor sweet rice next to the whatever it is, blueberry chutney, two or three drinks, this lassi and that lassi, and always minimum two, three sabjis, puris, samosa, there's always samosa, some kind of pastry. So I just decided immediately knew this is the community that I want to be part of. So I moved in and stayed there for a while. But then I'd come down from Vancouver with some friends and they'd track me down. So I had to go back up to Vancouver because I was a Canadian. I didn't know about staying. So I left, went back up to Vancouver. And then I didn't actually go into the temple that time. I went to the temple, but they said you have to live outside for a little while and come regularly. I said, okay. And then one night I was in a movie line. We get into a movie and the devotees were working the movie line. So they saw me. So the president said, all right, you can move in. So I moved into the Vancouver temple. That was in late 69, after having lived in San Francisco temple for a few weeks. And there were like four of us. And it was quite austere. Four brahmacharis, and we had no money. We were in a warehouse. That was our temple, on the roof of a warehouse. We had a little kind of apartment. And so we had to hitchhike downtown every day to do Harinam. And usually one person would chant and two would distribute mantra cards. not exactly a giant Hari Nam party. So
your service was to go on Hari Nam all day, every day?
That was it, every day, all day, except for Sunday, which then the service was to cook and eat as much as you can. preach a little bit too. And well, I guess I met and even helped devotees like Bahudak and Balakrishna and others become devotees. Mergendra, the lawyer, used to come there, and I would preach to him every Sunday. And he's a brilliant guy, brilliant Jewish guy. Ultimately became a New York University law graduate. I think he went to Brooklyn Law School. Anyway, he became a lawyer, did quite well. But when he came to me, he was like, whoa, he was eating out of garbage cans at the University of British Columbia. It was avaduta, completely transcendental. So, preaching, and who else was there? Bhumna Das. He came a little later from Eastern Canada. So we had a friendship. And Mahatma, our president was Chidananda, and he was a very transcendental person. He was very attractive to me because he was, I think he was more shy than I had been. It's funny, when I came to devotional service and I started preaching, I lost my shyness. I guess I just found something to speak about. That Radharani, she was blind until Krishna looked in her cradle. Her eyes were tight shut, and as soon as he looked in her cradle, she opened her eyes. And Balaram also, he was almost, his parents did not know what to do with him, whether he was abnormal or he would improve, but he didn't laugh, he didn't play, he didn't do anything. But when his little brother, Krishna, came, he became full of love. Or even when Mother Yashoda would take her on his lap, take him on her lap and talk about Krishna. So I don't know, it's one of those kind of things. Nobody can believe I was shy when I was young. But till I came to devotional service, that's so then Chidananda left, so Karander came up. He was the GBC at that time. This was 1970, just after Prabhupada had formed the GBC. And I guess, I don't know whether it was GBC or he was just given charge of the West Coast. But anyway, he came up to Vancouver and he assessed the situation. Then he called one devotee from San Diego named Mahatma Das. He took over from Chidananda. Then I went down for the Rath Yatra in 1970. I'd been to the Rath Yatra in 69. I went down in 70 and I met Prabhupada. hundreds of other devotees. But then I went to Los Angeles and got initiation, and I can't remember whether I went back to Vancouver or stayed in Los Angeles, but I know I ended up in Los Angeles, and I was the Sankirtan director for a while. And then Shilavati, who was the pujari in ISKCON practically. LA was the headquarters, and the Prabhupada wanted to be a showcase, a model where all the temples could come and see deity worship, etc. So he gave a lot of instruction to Shilavati, and she was having difficulty worshiping three big altars. So she wanted some help, and so she somehow or other trained up three males, Dhruvananda, Jayatirtha, and myself. So I became a pujari and a cook, and I was sent to San Francisco sometime thereafter. Almost got married, actually, at that time. Good, very good girl, good woman, still strong in devotional service. But she took too long to make up her mind. I didn't know her, I hadn't met her, but the president on my behalf asked her, and she said, I want to make up my mind. And in the interim, I changed my mind. So I was sent to Los Angeles, to San Francisco, because they had just moved from Haight-Ashbury to Mission District, and had a new temple, which was formerly a morgue, and new altars and big deities. So I took charge of that. There were 35 brahmacharis. And they were all book magazine distributors at that time, going out of Powell and Market Street and every day distributing morning, noon, and night. We used to go at midnight, we'd go to Hare, to the musical Hare, as the doors opened and the crowd came out after seeing the final scene of all the hippies on stage naked chanting Hare Krishna. They would come out and greet us, and we had three guitar players, and one of them was Ramanuja from South Africa, Jack. I remember him.
Ramanujacharya?
Yeah, Ramanujacharya. You know him?
I've met him a couple of times.
Yeah, yeah. So he was there. And so we would pass out incense and, you know, hit people up for donations with conch shells. I think we used conch shells, you know, big conch shells, stick it in their stomach. Whatever. Well, that was good. People were happy to get the incense and to hear the holy name. They were already primed for hearing, because the end of the show was Hare Krishna. And the Beatles, of course, were chanting at that time, and so many things were going on. So I remember we had this one driver, Makanlal, and we'd be at North Beach, which was the movie area, and we only till late at night, till 11:30, and we only had a short time to get over to where the theater district was, where Hare was playing. And so we'd all pile in the back of this big Herald Examiner van. Everybody crowded in. It was like cramped to the maximum. We were like sardines in a sardine can. And so Makanlal was our driver. And Makanlal was famous because he could fall asleep anywhere. And one time he came down in St. Louis to wake up the deities in the early morning, and the devotees found him offering his obeisances fully asleep. But he was our driver, and he, you know, he was bold. He was dedicated. He is dedicated. Probably take some sun, take sannyas soon. But he would drive our van sometimes down the wrong way on a one-way street, and if we'd encounter traffic, we'd go up on the sidewalk, and we just had to get there in time. It was a very inspiring, enlivening period. We were young. I think, who was it, Rancho read from a poem, when was it, at the anniversary here this year. It was great to be there at that time and to be young. So that's sort of, it really was great to be there at that time and be young. I don't know if it'll ever happen again like that, but if we were, everybody was just, we were very close to each other in certain ways. Maybe not maturely, but like, you know, in desperation, we're trying to rush out of the spirit, out of the material world. And we had no idea of lifelong devotional service. Because we were young. For a young person to think of lifelong is like a contradiction. Your life is short. How are you going to think lifelong? So, after that, this devotee, Jai Shri, she came to San Francisco. I needed help, and I guess she had made up her mind by that time. But, so she came to help out with the deity worship because none of the brahmacharis wanted to do anything but magazines. So at that time, the first traveling Sankirtan bus got started, a big gray old army bus. And I just decided I'm going to go on book distribution. I was going to stay there. So I jumped on the bus. And I left, and so for the next year or two, I was distributing books. And it was very enlivening, very inspiring. It was difficult. It's not that, it was an austerity. It was not, I mean, you're approaching people who think you're weird, and you're trying to sell them a magazine which they can't relate to at all, or even books. And you don't really know the philosophy that well yourself, and the more you're taught also not to spend too much time with each person, otherwise you won't make any sales. So every day to go out in any kind of incumbent weather or any environment, whether there are police or not, you know, every day it was like, it was a struggle, it was hard. But I did well, and I guess there were two of us, especially at that time, who were, by 1972, two of us who were very good, Buddhimanta Das and myself. So we were sent to London to train up the devotees in London how to go out on the street and get money, pick, and also distribute books. And so we came here, And at that time, the temple was at Bury Place, and it was, you know, a staircase temple, very narrow staircase going up six floors, and devotees were on all the floors. It was quite crowded. It was nice. It was a very nice temple. And but then there was some politics where our collection should go. Shamsundar, who was the president at the manor, or the GBC, sort of like, I guess you could say he was, yeah, in charge of the UK. He wanted that our collection should stay in the UK, and Keshava, who was the president of San Francisco, he said, no, there are devotees, they're training your people up, and they should come back to San Francisco. They couldn't agree, so Keshava came through, and he wanted to take the money and go off, and so Buddhimanta went with him, and I split up, because I didn't like that idea.
What year was this?
72.
Right.
Huh?
Yeah.
So, September, October. So then I said, well, I'm halfway to India, so let me see what it's like. And I was Canadian, so we didn't need a visa for India, Commonwealth, British Commonwealth. And so we went on to, I went on to India, I went to Delhi, just missed Prabhupada in Delhi. Not in Delhi, in Vrindavan. He just left for Hyderabad. So I met Gurudas and Jamuna there and stayed with them for a month. Did some preaching, and I went to Calcutta and ended up in Mayapur. For 6 months, worked with Jayapataka. And then Goswami Maharaj came through. He had this idea of a traveling party. And actually everybody's Guru Kripa and his and Yashodhanan, and they wanted to take me to Japan. I didn't want to go to the House of the Rising Sun. So I don't know if you know what House of the Rising Sun is, but
I know, I remember the song.
Can't
remember who sang it.
Well, the House of the Animals are burdened animals.
Right.
It was something like a whorehouse or something.
Oh, right. Okay. I didn't know that meaning.
So, Guru Kripa had his own version. There is a house just east of India. They call the Rising Sun. And it's been the ruin of many a poor brahmachari. And God, I think I'm one. So I didn't want to go there to Japan. He was collecting a lot of money, but I think their sadhana, etc., was not so good. We were just out collecting all day and all night. They lost some men. So I Prabhupada said I should stay in India because I was Canadian. Actually, I told Guru Kripa, I'm ready to go. We have to check with Prabhupada. And then to Prabhupada, I said, well, I'm Canadian and I don't have any trouble for visa, but I'm ready to go to Japan. Prabhupada, I guess he could understand. So no, I stay in India. So then Goswami Maharaj got me in Mayapur and took me on his traveling Sankirtan party, and that was a party to end all parties. We had three jeeps and three trailers behind, and let's see who was there in our party. It was Goswami Maharaj, Garga Muni Swami, Hari Kesha, Achyutananda Swami, Who else? Gopal Swami. And, quite a dynamic party. Dinanath, the most famous blues singer in ISKCON. We had nice programs. We traveled across India, went to big factories, did programs in big pandals to thousands and thousands of people. We had the Achyutananda show. You know, he would sing bhajans with his tampura. And he was very good. Definitely a Gandharva of some kind. And then we came to Bombay, and that was the time of the, what shall we say, the beginning of the struggle with Mr. Nair and everything. So the temple had just been demolished, and so Tamal, being the GBC of India, he was assigned to stay there and help out, and so he kept us there. We ended up downtown, going out every day.
What year did you go to Bombay?
What year was that? 72. Oh. Yeah. So more or less I remained there until 70. Of course, 75, I took sannyas in Vrindavan. And then Prabhupada sent me to Calcutta.
How did that work with taking sannyas? Was it that it was just recommended to you by somebody? Or?
No, I wanted to take sannyas. Actually, I had requested in 74, but I think Rishi Kumar had fallen down and somebody else had fallen down. I'm not sure whether Tamal put my name forward or what, but somehow or other, it was not an auspicious year. I had no interest by that time in family life. I guess it was always there. From the very beginning, I had a certain coldness, and although externally I'm a very friendly, jolly type of person, but internally I'm not emotional about the material world at all. I don't see anything here of value. It's all will-o'-the-wisp. So, as far as household life was concerned, it was just a way to gratify the genital. And even that I didn't understand much, because for different people it means different things, but you know, especially for a man, he will trade relationship for gratification. And even that is, you know, in a sexual relationship, there is a lot of petting and whatever, the foreplay. So that means more to some people, and to me it didn't mean anything. I couldn't even, you know, spitting in each other's mouths and, you know, rubbing skin. I can rub my skin, I know. I don't get off with that, you know. So I just thought, for a few moments of pleasure, you're going to, you know, enter into a contract which neither of you will be satisfied by, and I just decided I don't want to, you know, not that I couldn't have done my duty, not that I couldn't have been a good grihastha, but I was in India. India played a big role in molding the development of my maturity in Krishna consciousness. It was very important. I don't think I could have survived if I hadn't been in India. It was both very sobering in terms of seeing the miserable condition of the material world, and it was also a place where you could see the last vestiges of a culture which was extant on this planet at one time. And so it just gave you a very broad understanding of what you were receiving. It was coming down from tradition and where it could lead to. So anyway, I took sannyas, and I was all ready to go traveling and preaching. That was my motive. This is what happened. I liked public lectures. Somehow I just enjoyed it. And I thought, as a brahmachari, I am obscured. And in India, I was obscured by many sannyasis and senior people. And even there were sannyasis who were junior to me, in the sense of they joined later, they were younger, they didn't have the experience. But because they were sannyasis, they got to preach. So I thought, all right, I don't want to get married. And there's always, if you're not married, there's always that little thing in the back of your head, should I, shouldn't I? And I thought, I got to kick this out. Once you've taken a vow, that's it. You stop thinking about it. There's no should I, shouldn't I. So you no longer have that option. So I put my name, and Gopal Krishna Moharaj, that time Gopal Krishna Das Adhikari, he wanted to keep me in Bombay, so he wasn't going to put my name up to Prabhupada.
What service were you doing in Bombay? Was it life membership?
In fact, I remember once everybody in India, Prabhupada knew them on a name-to-name basis, a face-to-face basis. Anyway, he recognized you. He knew you. And so I had done lots of services for Prabhupada. I was his driver for a while. And, you know, we stayed a long time in Bombay. Anyway, I wanted to take some years. Gopal wanted to keep me. So I said, all right, I'm going to leave anyway. I'm going to travel, preach. So then he went to Prabhupada and said, Prabhupada, Sridhar is leaving. He wants to take sannyas. Let's keep him somehow, force him. I said, no, he can take sannyas. And then there was Gopal, I think it was the GBC of India by that time. So there was a problem in Calcutta. Bhagavat had made a big scandal and everything was disturbed. So, you know, I went to Vrindavan. Prabhupada told me, you want to wait till the Mayapur festival? It's the first time I was bold with Prabhupada. I said, Prabhupada, we have a way of dealing with life members when they say, well, maybe I'll become next month or next year. And then we say Ravan told Lakshman, if there's an auspicious thing, you shouldn't wait, you should do it immediately. Subhashya Shigram. So I said that. I said, all right, you come with me to Vrindavan. And then Lokanath heard that I was taking sannyas. although he was a junior brahmachari, but I guess he was really a sannyasi covered by brahmachari vesh. So he, I don't know what transpired, but he got permission to follow, to come with me. So we went to Vrindavan, and another sannyasi, Malati's a husband, a second husband, Prithaputra. He actually, Prabhupada didn't want to give him sannyas, but he pressured her at that time. No, Prithaputra. No, he was. Yeah, at that time he was married to Vishwadevi. And so he wanted, they were both French and they were both fighting like cats and dogs. So what Dixon? Prabhupada didn't want to give him, but he forced him. So Prabhupada agreed. So the three of us took sannyas. And there's a famous picture of Prabhupada giving beads to one Arya Dasi.
Oh, I've heard of her. She's from Canada.
Yeah, that's right. Vijayta Andarya. Very good woman. Very good woman. You should contact her. And anyway, a nice photo of her. Quite famous. And so at that same ceremony, we took sannyas. And then, you know, I stepped outside the temple with my danda and here I am, I'm going to go and preach. And then all these people started bowing down. And I thought, oh, no, I didn't want this. But that's what happened. So anyway, I went back to Bombay and met Prabhupada there. I was all ready to go to the West. And Prabhupada said, so, you go to Calcutta and be the president there. And I didn't want to go. So finally, I had to surrender. I went to Calcutta for 6 months and was the president. Straightened everything out, got everything back on track, and then I put Abhiram in charge. He was in Mayapur at the time. It was at that time that Prabhupada was providing a flat for his former wife and kids. So I was working with Prabhupada on that. And I arranged for the flat and the furniture and everything. Prabhupada would take instruction from him and execute it. So, but then I... And I was... Garga Muni came through with 6 Mercedes vans, which he drove overland from Germany, and you know, it was just so attractive. He had 35 men, 35 brahmacharis. They were going to all the libraries, and you know, he was unabashedly asking everyone to come with him. And I said, "Yeah, I want to go." So I, Prabhupada was upset, actually. Anyway.
He wanted you to stay
in Calcutta. Calcutta. Yeah, because we were working together, you know, quite fine. You know, I guess, you know, I've been in India a long time and I get along with Indians very well. Anyway, whatever. Picking up a little Bengali. So he, I put Abhiram in my place and took off. Then we traveled around India, and I enjoyed that time the best I've ever enjoyed in Krishna consciousness. Garga Muni did all the management. He arranged for everything. We had a cook traveling with us, Shantilal, a Marwadi cook, comes from Marwad, the place in Rajasthan where all the big businessmen are from. And he was a Brahmin and he was a great cook. And, you know, Garga Muni was like Ganesh. He was very particular about his food. And so he would have Shantilal cook at any time, day or night, for him and his men. It was very good, Garga Muni, taking care of his men. Very smart man, too bad that... Anyway. I remember he had this policy. It was so funny. If somebody left his party, because there wasn't a, unless you created it, there wasn't a whole lot of spiritual activity. It was work. And he was very good at that. He would get up in the morning. He was one of the Calcutta temple presidents, but he would get up in the morning and the first thing he'd do would be to read the papers, and especially the obituaries, to see who had died. And then he would immediately send them flowers and sweets. And then like 10 days or 12 days afterwards, he'd go and ask for a donation, because that's the custom. 12 days afterwards, you're giving charity to a Brahmin. Who's that focused? So, Garga Muni, I traveled with him, and he did all the management. I just preached to the Brahmacharis. We'd give classes. And sometimes Garga Muni and I would go out and make life members. I would just be the sadhu and preach from the Bhagavatam. He would offer the benefits of membership, and he had this Polaroid camera. That was one of the benefits. You know, you take your photo and give your photo to you right there. It's so funny. So then we traveled around, and then we came to Bombay. And there was a problem in Hyderabad. And Prabhupada was there in Bombay, so he asked me to go to Hyderabad to become the president. And I was finished with Garga Muni by that time, and I was really thinking of doing my first world tour, you know. And so I just, at first I said, but Prabhupada had plans to travel and preach, and then he didn't say anything. Just looked away and talked to something else that night. I thought, oh, God. Next day I went to him and said, all right, Prabhupada, I'll do whatever you want. I don't want to be sorry, you just go there. We'll see about president later. Of course, I became the president. And then that continued up until the time Prabhupada left.
Where were you when
Germany? Yeah, I was in Vrindavan. And Prabhupada said he was going to stay. He promised us. He said, all right, I'll stay. And, you know, I started drinking and eating again. And it seemed like he was going to improve, because Krishna said that whatever he wants, and he had asked us, and we said we want him to stay, so he agreed. And I thought, okay, then I'll get back to work now. I went to Germany to get a vehicle, and about 2 weeks later he left. And I heard, gosh, I guess everybody, you know, it was stunning. Like a bird flying in the sky and being stunned by hearing Krishna's flute and just falling out of the sky, or like one of the wives of the demigods being pregnant, hearing Krishna's flute and having a miscarriage, you know. It was real stunning. Anyway, had to carry on. I came back to India, drove across land from Germany, got stuck in Istanbul. In the winter, we came in the winter. You can imagine November the 11th was, or November 14th was Prabhupada's disappearance, 1977. And shortly after that, we left. So we were caught up. We drove through the mountains in Turkey. And anyway, that was an experience. I got stuck in Istanbul for a month. One of my vehicles broke down, and I didn't have money to repair it, and I got cheated. And so I lived in the back of a Kulwagen, a German freezer truck that I got in Germany very cheaply because it didn't have a TÜV, a sticker for being roadworthy. And so, although it was in pretty good condition, big 911 Mercedes diesel truck, good for India, for Sankirtan, which is what we were going to do, but I didn't have money. Didn't require a whole lot because diesel was so cheap in those Mideast countries, practically like water. And so I ended up in Istanbul, staying in the back of that Kühlwagen on one of the shelves where they would formerly put the milk cartons or whatever. I was with some other brahmachari. So finally a Treya Rishi in Tehran, which was right next door, he sent some money and bailed us out, and we went to Iran. Stayed there for about a month or so. So that was like December. We were in Istanbul. January we came to Iran. And then we left a month or so after, sometime February, March, I think. We left for India with a group of devotees. We drove overland to India for the festival. It was quite an experience. Iran was nice at that time. The Shah was still in power. It was just before he was deposed. And at that time, Parivrajakacharya was teaching yoga to Reza Pahlavi, the daughter of the Shah of Iran, teaching her yoga and mantra meditation. Amazing. Islamic country, Tehran. So, it was nice. We had a Treya Rishi was there, and he had a big building in the center of the city. He was Arthur Young and Company's representative there. He was a director of the company, and he went there as a director to establish their base, and then he stole all their clients and started his own business and became very successful, quite wealthy. He had a big home in the wealthiest area. He had a 4 or 5 story building downtown Iran. And he rented this restaurant, Govinda's. Govinda's on Avenue Shemshad, number 3. At the corner of Shah Reza and Koh. And actually, Shah Reza was one of the main streets in the city. If you ask any Iranian, they know, oh yes, Shah Reza. Now it's not called Shah Reza. Since the Shah was deposed, all the names were changed. But Koh, very famous. And Iranian boys would come, and Dayananda was there, and Nandarani, and who else? Some other devotees were there. Bharga. He actually eventually met Khomeini, Bharga. He was an Iranian devotee, but from America, come from America, I think, studied in America. And let's see, I think Kundali was there. Some other devotees. But there was no deity worship. That would have been a giveaway. We couldn't do that. That was illegal. But we would have the restaurant, and we'd preach to chant the names of Allah. And it's nice. Nice boys, nice people. More educated than others in the area. I think the Persians are the ones who really added culture to Islam. Architecture and music, etc., came from Persia. So then we drove across land to India, and then I went back to Hyderabad, and then by that time I think Hansaduta had become the GBC, and that was my cue to exit stage left.
It was 78 by now.
Yeah, I know. It was, let's see, it was 78, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Right.
And, let's see.
So you left?
Yeah, I came to Bombay.
Right.
Mm. And, stayed there ever since, mostly.
Working on life?
Life membership. I've been the president twice. I've been regional secretary, I've been the GBC. Mm. Everybody and his uncle know me. Mm.
Is that still your base now?
Yeah, more or less. They have kind of trapped me there. I have a nice facility there, but right now I could stay anywhere, actually. Vancouver, they want me to stay there.
Is fundraising your main thing that you're working on?
Mm-hmm.
Is fundraising mainly what you work on?
I think what is going to happen, I was a GBC man for about 10 years, and then I just resigned, and they made me a GBC emeritus. Mm-hmm. But my field was fundraising ministry. I guess I have more experience than anyone in ISKCON in professional fundraising. Read more, studied more, and done more. Being connected with big projects and whatever. Naveen Krishna and I at one point were traveling around doing seminars on fund development, actually, it's known as. Right now, I'm connected with the Mayapur Temple of Vedic Planetarium Fund Development Project, and I'm trying to help out a little bit in Moscow, in New York probably, but I think for the next little while I may focus on health, because that hepatitis C kicked in about 97, and for the last 6 years, in 2000 I was in a coma twice. And my doctor recently in Vancouver said, actually, you're dead. You should be dead. So, I don't know. I'm just kind of going on extension of visa. But right now, I don't... I may just go back to Bombay and take care of my health. I'm not sure. It's not easy for me. After a lifetime of traveling and preaching, there's two things. One is the service itself is very nice for someone who has no particular zonal attachments or family attachments or anything else to do. Traveling and preaching is very nice. And then the other thing is that I just don't know about my health. I'm not taking any allopathic medicine. As you can see, I'm taking lots of herbal medicine, but I'm surviving, but there's no cure in sight. And it could get the better of me at any moment right now. I'm probably, this is one of the worst situations I've been in for a long time. I'm hoping in India things will get better, but don't really care. But, you know, I don't want to go to Vrindavan and sit down and chant Hare Krishna and wait for death to catch up to me. I would rather be die on an airplane somewhere going for a preaching project. And everybody has his own choice, you know, how you want to die. You do have to die. 55 seems a little young, but it's all up to Krishna. Pain is certainly... There's a saying you probably heard, in this world, pain is inevitable. Suffering is an option.
I haven't heard that one.
It's quite appropriate.
Meditate on that one.
Yeah, if you don't want to suffer, you don't have to suffer. Pain will be there, but for me it's an education. And whatever Krishna wants to dole out to me, it's, I deserve much worse. Obviously it's coming from a previous lifetime, because in this lifetime, relatively speaking, I've been a pretty good boy. But some previous lifetime I must have committed heinous sins. Or maybe Krishna is using me to encourage people. You know, if I just go to a temple and don't do anything, I just show up there and come to the temple once or twice, people can see that, yeah, we have a tradition. Here's one of our pillars. So they get inspired like that. If I'm able to do a little preaching, then I feel satisfaction and I get enlivened, and perhaps that does more for my health than any other thing. Being enlivened, depression is the worst thing for a sick person, because it leads to a situation like starving people. They get into a situation where they can't be fed. It becomes, what's the right word? They become so locked in that if you try to feed them anything but the lightest of substance, of juice, or even, you know, it'll kill them. They're on a trajectory that's, they're going to starve to death. Happens with these people, these Irishmen in the IRA.
Oh, when they do, you mean when they do hunger strikes?
Yeah.
Those kind of people.
Yeah, they get into a situation where you can't retrieve them after 50 days, 45 days. If they really wanted to change, very hard. So, I don't think. Be happy to. I don't want to get depressed.
This disc has run out, and
good.
I got all of that from just one question, which is very good. You've given me basically the whole chronology of your life in up till now, and there are some other questions that I could ask you about your views on different things, and I'm just wondering if you prefer to spend some more time, or if you need to get somewhere, or if
you so want 10 to 12, so you got half an hour.
Okay, so let's put the next one. Okay, so first question was, How would you describe your relationship with devotees in your early days, and would you say it's different to what your relationships with devotees are like now?
No.
It's the same.
As I said, I was always searching for something in my youth that I missed in my childhood, and I found it in ISKCON. It's my family, and I like my family, I like my father, I like devotees, and I've always been very friendly. As far as I know, that's the way everybody remembers me, so it must be a fact. And of course I've offended people over the years due to passionate nature or whatever. I must say I don't fall in love with lazy people. I don't mind people who are failures, or as long as they're trying. But overall, even the sinful devotees, even those who tried a little bit and blooped, I have no problem meeting them later and embracing them and trying to encourage them even wherever they're at.
So you would describe your relationships like as family members?
Family member, and I guess it's my nature, but I just cannot role play that well.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I can't help it. It's not an enlightened decision on my part. It's just my nature. But and as I was saying this morning in class, there is a need for the awe-inspiring guru, the Aishwarya Bhav. But I have no problem. It's time to take prasad, and I'll sit down on the floor. Someone offered me prasad. Okay, I'll take prasad. But it's not that I, go get my cushion. Where's my medicine? I just sit down with devotees. I put my arm around devotees. I love devotees. I'm not threatened by women. All devotees.
The questions I'd like to ask about Prabhupada. When and where was the last time you saw Srila Prabhupada?
Vrindavan. 2 weeks before he left, approximately.
And then you went, because after that you went to...
back to Hyderabad and off to Germany.
How would you... Well, you probably... I think you answered it in class this morning already, but how would you describe your relationship with Prabhupada?
Just want to become a tiny little servant. While he was here, I was very shy with him. I had so many opportunities to talk to him. He acknowledged my presence, my service. But I didn't kept a distance for various reasons. Like everyone else, I was awe-inspired by him. I don't know the meaning of love. I don't know what it is. I never felt it before. I never loved anything or anybody. Yet. I think Prabhupada took it all. And so it's very, very hard to live without him. I just want to go and sit at his feet and talk to him, massage his feet, and I want to be alone with him and open my heart. I want him to clean my heart. I want to serve him eternally. I don't know what my relationship is with Prabhupada. I'm doing my duty for him. Otherwise, it's too hard to go on. I get strength from hearing about him. Anything. I get strength when I see someone glorifying him nicely. I'm enlivened when someone is able to do some devotional service that I know would please him. Thing that has any meaning in my life. Logic and argument. Anything. Nothing has meaning. Unless it's connected with him, I can't understand it.
think he did quite a nice job then. I mean, that was from the heart, so... A couple of devotees the other day, they were talking about dreams that they had as Srila Prabhupada.
Never.
Had any dreams?
No. Yeah. A lot.
Do you think your relationship with Prabhupada, did you sense that it changed in any way after he left, or is it... has it stayed the same for you?
No, I became more aware of it after he left. I don't think it was different. I was became more aware. I guess with every succeeding year, I'm more and more aware of how much I am dependent upon him. I can't do anything without him. And I know that in his memory, maybe I will be able to achieve some sort of advancement in devotional service. Maybe.
There's something that's, I guess, related to that. Did you find that after Prabhupada left, that Krishna consciousness, did it change for you in any way? How you...
No.
At all?
No, it's a very simple process. Chant Hare Krishna. Have no worries. Be happy. Those are his orders. It's very easy. Not a difficult process. We make it difficult. We extend ourselves beyond into our material lives. Yogakshema vahamyaham. I preserve what they have and I carry what they lack, but we don't have faith. So we start making our own arrangements. We get entangled. And when it comes time to surrender, we say, oh, it's very difficult, very complicated. No. Krishna consciousness is very easy. You just surrender to Krishna and accept whatever he gives you, and you'll see that he'll never give you anything. This is not for your spiritual development. And he'll never give you anything that's too difficult to digest. And if you ever get in trouble, he will help you out. If you ever find that there's too much pressure, then he'll relieve the pressure. But you'll never know until you try. Very simple process. Always was. I never had any problem with Krishna consciousness. It was developing. Now, I never had any doubt that I was on the right path, but getting freed from past anarthas, purifying existence, developing guru nishtha, and also learning how to relate to devotees in such a way that your imperfections did not disturb them, and yet your overall result of your overall, the overall impression they got from your association was one of being encouraged. We have to encourage each other. I'm very concerned for the family. As an elder member of our family, I'm very concerned. I'm concerned when I see my godbrothers fall down, and I know that it will disturb the faith of many second generation devotees. You know, just think how much your faith would be disturbed if Shonaka Rishi fell down. Probably shatter you a little bit.
Yeah, he's one of my gurus.
That's right. Yeah. So, one of my godbrothers who still, I'm sure he's a charming person, still he can tell Prabhupada stories until the cows come home. But he just did a very stupid thing. And it'll become apparent because it's right here in London. I don't know how devotees will, you know, devotees become more and more cynical. It's harder to preach, it's harder to resurrect the phoenix, it's harder to turn things around, it's harder to put forward, because the overall mood of Prabhupada disciples is they want to see Prabhupada recognized. All these bogus people are being recognized for bogus, completely superfluous achievements. From this Mahayogi to that one. And you know it's so just short term and shallow, no substance, cheaters and cheated. And here's a genuine sadhu who's done an incredible job at the fag end of his life under great pressure and strain, taking pints of his blood to give everything to us. And you want him to be recognized, let people recognize his contribution, and then you see foolish persons who should know better doing stupid things, so that hurts. I'm concerned, but I'm not strong enough physically. Or I would try to do more, but Krishna wants to keep me in this condition for a while. What else?
Well, I have more questions, but it depends on how much time you have.
Well, all we can do is try. We got 15 minutes more.
Okay. I'll just think of what are the most important ones. I could ask you some questions about ISKCON.
Go ahead.
And you don't have to answer all of these if you don't really want to, you can. The first one is, what do you see as being ISKCON's main
main success is surviving. We already have our game plan, the infrastructure is there, the blueprint is there, but if we don't survive, in the Bhagavatam the 8th canto, the 19th chapter, the 39th and 40th verses explain that the human body is auspicious because even though it's material, it gives, it's like a tree, it gives fruits and flowers, and those fruits and flowers are love of God. Even though it's a material thing, but just like a tree, without the tree you can't have the fruits and flowers. Without the human body, you can't get love of God, so therefore you have to take care of your body. That's Yukta Vairagya. Manushmriti also says the first law of Manu: survive, protect your life. If we don't survive as a community, as an institution, no matter how, we've already not done a very good job at marketing our ideas, and if we don't survive, if we just fight. So our success is that after Prabhupada's disappearance, having gone through many struggles, etc., we have survived. And now there's hope that if we continue struggling, then we'll be able to reform and develop a friendlier, kinder, gentler institution.
Okay, well, what do you see as ISKCON's main failures?
Failures? I don't see any failures. We lost some people. Losing devotees, that's our main failure. Our goal is not to distribute books or to archive Prabhupada's things. These are not our goals. Our goals are to make and keep Krishna conscious people. And to the degree that we do that, we may have strategies such as book distribution or preserving the works, etc. These are all strategies, but goals are people. In the course of growing and learning, of course you make mistakes. Try not to make them twice, or at least thrice.
How do you think ISKCON has changed since you joined? Do you think it has changed?
The first generation have become very old and not very old, but they become wiser. Their ranks have been thinned, and a lot of them are having physical problems. And the second generation, which should have been, in my estimation, should have been grandfathered in, are gradually starting to take over the institution. Better late than never. But I think it could have been done a lot earlier and a lot more smoothly, but just people are succumbing to pressure, to older age, to miraculously they're getting diseases which, you know, they really don't deserve. Why should Shivaram Swami be becoming so ill after all his years of brahmacharya and all his years of dedication and book distribution and sankirtan and preaching? Why is Niranjan Maharaj constantly suffering from health problems? Why is Radhana Swami, you know, almost on his, you know, practically every time you see him, he's like just coming out from No, he could, you know, he could die at any moment with his. When he was here in London, they were telling him, or in Bombay, they were telling him that if he doesn't be careful, he'll end up like Tribhuvanath. He was heading towards that condition. He had to go to Bangkok and rest for 2 months. And, you know, you name it, everybody's. Although you see corporate executives work until their 60s, 65, and they go full throttle, and they're no different than us. But somehow or other, Krishna's trying to put the first generation in exactly this kind of a role where they associate with devotees, inspire them, mentor, and then let go. Don't get involved in trying to direct things too much. Command respect by your activities. Demanding it will bring you nothing.
Are there any changes that you would like to see in ISKCON for the future? Or some kind of vision that you have?
Sure, I'd like to see. I'd like to see GBC men with contiguous zones, smaller, concentrating on being with people. I think Prabhupada did what he did out of necessity. I don't think it was his desire. He often said everybody should come to Mayapur every year. Nobody ever followed that. The leaders figured we couldn't afford it. Prabhupada said, you can afford to eat, can't you? He wanted to be with his devotees, with his disciples. Many disciples were very disturbed that they were not allowed to come when Prabhupada left and they missed his departure. But I think if he could have, he would have spent more time with his disciples collectively and individually. And I think that goal is more achievable by us now than ever. And I think it's more necessary because we don't have that bhav, that super position. Our Prabhupada was our acharya. We made him our acharya. We accepted him as our acharya. He could have been in the Gaudiya Math. He was just Abhay Babu, not a very important person. But Krishna chose for him to become what he finally did become, and he surrendered to that. So that's what the leader should do now. And there's got to be believers, people who believe in the innate good of devotees. We've got to learn to encourage devotees to come up to their highest potential. Not that we aren't prepared for them to fail miserably, but if you inveigh or you leave the impression with someone that you really aren't confident about their ability, then that's the level they'll come to. But if you somehow or other inspire them on the highest level, they'll come to higher levels. Prabhupada was able to do that. Go and open a printing press. He'd never seen a printing press, didn't even know how to work a printing press at all. The only contact he had was maybe to read a newspaper. Speech by World of Hare Krishna by Tom Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And he just said, do it, Krishna will help you. So we have to learn. And if something fails or something goes wrong, then we make adjustments. Progress, a series of adjustments in the right direction. An organization, it's never perfect in the beginning. It starts out as, much less than perfect. Until you have an organization, you can't have a good one. Until you have a good one, you can't have a perfect one. So we need that type of attitude and dealing. In the one sense, there's a sense of urgency to get things done, but we also have to be detached and prepared to rely on devotees. I don't know how many people think like this also. It means maybe everybody does think like this and they're working in that way, but I just don't see a lot of it. There's a result. You judge things by the result. There's something wrong. There's a pinprick somewhere in the devotee body. Why is there such a lack of general... No, the core devotees, the new devotees, maybe they have. But there is a great deal of frustration with our governing body, lack of trust, project, acharyaism. Well, we don't have zonal acharyas anymore, we have project acharyas. My project versus your project. Nothing like think globally and manage locally. No global thinking, or at least less. And no real intelligent approach to communicating with the rank and file devotees. Leaders need to get out. They need to be with the devotees in the field. I think one of the best examples I saw of a successful general was I forget his name. In the Gladiator. What was his name?
I didn't see it.
That general. Anyway, he was right there with his men. Mm-hmm. All the time. He was there in the battlefield with them. He was there after the battle. He loved them. They knew he loved them. He cared for them. He was chosen to be the Caesar of Rome. But he was, in his heart, he was a farmer. And he did his duty as a soldier. And fighting, he built a team through deep trust and faith and love. Our leaders have to get into the social body, and they have to reveal their mistakes, and they have to not appear to be like they're perfect in every way, and they have to embrace devotees and encourage them.
time for one more question. Okay, the last question is, as a senior member of our society, what would there be some advice that you would have for younger members of the society who are at the early stages of their devotional career?
Get education.
What kind of education?
Spiritual education. Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhava, Bhakti Sarvabhauma, whatever you can do. Learn as much as you can, because that will serve you. Work, don't be afraid to work. Whenever you, it used to be that you worked, and whenever you get a chance, read a little bit. Now it should be study, and whenever you get a chance, work a little bit. There's a need for, because we're better suited. In my day, there was no VIHE or MIHE or Radha Deshaihe or whatever it is. None of this going on, no courses, no new bhakti course, nothing. I learned whatever I learned. Probably I learned everything I know when I was with Garga Muni and he did all the management in a few months. I did more reading and more preaching at that time than ever. Maybe I don't know much, but I'm a good bluffer. So I, any disciples I have, I encourage them to try to, if they have any interest at all. They don't have to. If you work, I've grown up as a worker. Whatever realizations I have, it's come from Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam, using my senses to serve the mission. I've been a company man all my life. So someone may not be inclined. But anyone has even a little inclination. Don't worry. Don't worry about your temple. Don't worry about anything. Get an education. Later on you can do a huge amount of service. But you'll have so much knowledge to give you shelter, to pass on, to make your life enlivening.
Thank you very much for tolerating all my questions. One more thing I need to ask you to do. It's just with every interview that we do, we just ask the person who did the interview to sign this form, which signs over the copyright to us, which means that, you know, we have the right, you know, to keep this interview, and if we might want to use it as part of something, you know, some kind of publication or something, that we could. If there's anything that you didn't want to be made public, then we can put a restriction on any part of it. Okay, we just like to offer that. I mean, usually people are okay with that, but at least, you know, we like to offer that as an option. I can get your all your details off Mukunda if you like. I just need you to sign it, and just says, do you want your name to be disclosed, yes or no? Because sometimes if we use something, we can, you can be anonymous. You don't care. Okay, so I just need to sign.
No, let me pull it up first.
Okay.
such a repetitive crew of people who went around helping for the
Lilamrita. Yeah.
No, not Lilamrita.
No?
Lilamrita. You're a scholar, yes.
I'm not really a scholar, but well, actually, I'm not a scholar.
Rita is a girl who lives in South America.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of the materials, some was kept on the East Coast and some was kept on the West Coast, and I forget which one, but some of it got destroyed in a fire.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? That's so much hard work.
Yeah.
So much more could have been there. But actually it opened the door for others to write their books.
Yeah.
Who was it? Same guy at John Hopkins. What was his name?
He was a scholar?
Yeah, Thomas.
Thomas Hopkins.
Tom Hopkins. Anyway, Hari Sori called him up and wanted him to write the foreword to his second volume. And the guy started laughing on the phone. Said, the Christians have, you know, maybe a few books about Jesus. Muslims, a few books about Muhammad. He said, you Hare Krishnas, you got a book for every day in the life of Prabhupada. Yeah, people are still writing books. Prabhupada in Malaysia, Prabhupada in Australia, Prabhupada in Durban, Prabhupada.
That's okay. We're the Sampradaya of the book. So.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
Here. Not in Norwegian, but rest of it.
Nah.
It's okay.
Airport. So you were with that group of interviewers?
No, that's a little bit too young for that. Or devotionally young, anyway. But this project, I'm just starting off. I'm just kind of in a...
How old are you?
I'm 35.
Okay.
I joined a bit late.
Let me see your right hand. Other one.
Oh.
No rings, huh?
No.
You're not married. Why?
I don't know. Krishna doesn't seem to want it at the moment.
You don't want it, or he doesn't want it?
No, you're he doesn't open. Want it. Even my guru's tried to.
Oh, tried to get you married.
Yeah.
Who's your guru?
Ravindra Sarup Prabhu.
Oh,
yeah.
He's so nice. But I don't know if he has a big agenda to get his disciples married.
No.
He doesn't really travel that widely. And
no, he doesn't take a very sort of controlling role in his disciples' lives, but he definitely is concerned for their welfare.
But he's not going to take care of you in your old age.
No.
You need to find a husband.
Yeah.
Maybe you should be a little more proactive.
Yeah, well, let's see.
You have bio data?
Sorry?
You have your bio data?
I have a CV.
CV, yeah, circumvita.
Yeah. You suggesting I should...
No, send it to some temples and say that this is your... I wouldn't... It's a business deal.
Yeah, it's...
You need a partner in your business of life. It's not, you know, the sexual thing that's long gone. I mean, someone could be older. One of my disciples, she just... I'm hoping it'll be consummated next year, but a widower in Vancouver, very nice man. He had a very nice wife, but she died, and now he needs a companion. She's 37, and never been married, always dedicated to Body Shop. She was their biggest manager in Canada for 10 years in a row. But no person, you know, not thinking about her life. And then she came to Krishna consciousness. And, you know, it's kind of, it's not a single woman's movement. It's not that friendly in some sense.
Yeah, I mean, Prabhupada was always very much emphasizing.
But he did say all women should be married.
Yeah, we were nearing a Jagatarini, they had a marriage.
Huh? Yeah, immediately. Jagatarini, she's a great lady. Really,
yeah, she's
great
wonderful.
Lady. So, but I would say you should, no harm, no, nothing lost. Just say these, you know, you're an intelligent girl, you have a nice service, you're attractive, you know, you have, you should have a husband. No reason why you can't. A lot of things don't happen in this world just because nobody else knows how to market them. Normally your parents would do all this for you.
Yeah, your dad would make sure your father wouldn't rest until...
Yeah, your mother would drown herself in the Ganges if you weren't married by the time you were 14, you know. But that, those days are gone, but still. Send it around to a few temple presents. Just... in a light way, say, you know, if something comes up, I'm open.
Consider your suggestion.
But you won't take it because it's just not...
Oh, it's not my...
it's not know. Your style.
No, not really.
You want to fall in love with someone.
No, I don't believe in that anymore.
Yeah.
Being purged of that.
No, love takes place from service and trust.
Yeah, real love.
It's yeah, but real love is to come, you go watch Gandhi again.
Him and his wife.
He describes to the American journalist how he and his wife were married. And even Prabhupada quotes from Gandhi. One time Gandhi got angry at his wife and said, leave. She left, and she left the house and just sat down at the front gate. Finally came to her and said, come back. Prabhupada, in regards to householders having arguments, she had nowhere to go. She was already... And so you need that kind of... A woman's strength comes from her chastity. A man's strength comes from his celibacy. Iti shushrumna dhirana. But a woman's strength comes from her chastity. She needs a pati bhagavan. Someone she can serve intimately. As a service. May not even like the guy.
Like you say, when you serve, then you know attachment comes from serving.
Not wrong. At your age, it's probably not going to be. Well, 35. I mean, see, medically, women who don't have any children, their menopause comes early.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they're 50% more likely to develop uterine cancer.
Oh, really?
Well, you have so many hormones that are meant for producing children. Ask any nurse, any doctor.
Yeah.
It's a statistic, although, you know, I'm sure there are studies that minimize that, but in general, the principle is your body is suited for that.
Yeah, I was hearing just the other day, Queen Elizabeth, that was one big criticism of her. She never produced any... children, and you know, that's part of what women's bodies are for. She didn't produce an heir. You know,
the body is for that, your soul is for Krishna. You're Krishna's, we're all gopis in relationship to Krishna, nobody's male or female. But we have to play our roles as long as we're in these bags of stool in your hand. We have to act according to the laws. But, you know, at 35, you're not that strong. You can even if you just had one child. But you should, I would say, you know, it's almost like now or never.
Yeah,
it's not fun being 60 and being alone, or 50. If you've had the experience of family life and you're finished with it, that's one thing.
Yeah, I think it's a, it is a problem in our movement. There's a lot of
very much
unmarried women in the
very much a problem. We're not getting shelter. And there's a saying, you know, I mean, I think, frankly, that women should not be discouraged from marrying non-devotee men who are vegetarians and who are respectful. There's lots of Indians in that category who could be really good husbands, but they're just not, they never lived in an ashram, they're not initiated.
That makes a difference.
Huh?
Well, someone who's coming, who's been ashram trained, and someone who hasn't, sometimes there's a difference in
not really. You have, it depends on who you meet and what kind of contract you make, but you have your devotional life, and even if you get a husband at the time of death, you're on your own. And so that's something that goes on. Now, you will get something out of a marriage which you need, just like taking disciples for me was a big thing. It gave me an opportunity to again develop as a parent, in the sense that again it's part of the same thing. What I missed in my youth and my childhood has been brought out in my service now. An opportunity to be concerned, to try to help in whatever way, even if it's not even taken as help, still I get a chance to feel like I'm helping. And so, you know, there's something psychological about, Prabhupada said that women who are married when they're 10 years old or 9 years old or whatever, psychologically they think, my husband is there. Now they may not live with them till they're 15 or whatever, 14, but in their minds they're satisfied, they're peaceful. And psychologically, again, a woman has a relationship with her husband. He's the first man that she knows. And, you know, she becomes very attached to him, so she'll never think of anything else. If she has many affairs when she's young, then she'll get attached to variety and it'll be hard for her to stay with one man. But if her first man is her husband, psychologically she's set. And if her husband is a nice devotee, then of course she's set in devotional service. Women don't go to Gurukula. They're trained at home how to be good wives. Now why is that? Once they get a husband, they take on the varna of their husband. They naturally get all the pious credits of their husband. So, the psychological aspects of the species. Men are different, women are different. Not, one's not inferior to the other, they're just different. Modern society says, why do you treat women as inferior? We don't. You've made up this superior, inferior. They're just different. They have different psychological roles to play.
Yeah, it's quite quite shocking to see how women are being portrayed these days in the media.
They're being what?
The way they're presenting women, like in advertising and media. It's just,
oh, shocking.
I'm just so...
it's really... it's demonic, heavily demoniac, and women are so foolish, they're thinking that they get a little... What is it? Good girls go to heaven, bad girls just have fun.
Well, bad girls are the one I saw. Some people I work for, they have it in their house in their daughter's room. She's only 2 years old. Good girls go to heaven, bad girls go everywhere.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you put that in your daughter's room?
Yeah, it's so stupid. It's
horrible.
Yeah. So that they're heavily in the bodily concept of life, and they're generally, women are not philosophical, or at least they're less philosophical than men. They have other strengths which men don't have, and they complement each other, but they can be misled. And here you have these unscrupulous men misleading women into thinking, you know, be independent. And by the way, I have an apartment, let's go and have an affair. And there's a reaction now. Women are becoming very cold, and they're also fighting back. That's madness. The goal is to become Krishna conscious, not to, so you can win the battle of the sexes. I have no pride in being a male. I couldn't care less.
It's just an external designation.
It really is.
It's not who we are.
No, it's not. But we need to play our roles properly.
Yeah, until
we don't disturb each other.
Yeah, it's true.
Because it's a fact. My body will be agitated by a woman's body. Nature. We're animals.
Yeah.
So women have to downplay for everybody except for their husband. And men have to see all women as their mother, except for their wife. And a wife has to be a friend, a mother, a lover, or a prostitute. And she has many roles to play with her husband. But with other men, she's very chaste. Won't even talk. Prophet said his mother would not go next door. His grandmother would not go next door. Wouldn't go next door unless there was an invitation, a carriage sent, and a chaperone.
That's culture, isn't it?
That's culture. We need a dose of that. I think you should make an attempt. Just, you know, in other words, if you're waiting for a magic wand to come out of the sky and tap you on the head, well, you'll be an old hag before that happens.
Yeah, I'm not so...
Huh?
I'm not so proactive.
You're not so proactive. Well, how'd you get this job with the archives? They just came and said, hey, we want you to do the service, or you said, I'd like to do the service.
It's a long story, actually, but I left my service here, and I just went to Shaunaka and asked him if he had any.
Okay, you were proactive.
Well, I kind of...
Yeah, you were proactive.
I didn't really fit with the temple anymore, so...
That's all right. You were looking for some service.
Yeah, I had to.
You could have just gone home.
Oh, yeah. I can't really say I have a...
Could have gone out and got a job.
Yeah, not in England.
Some do.
I can't work here, only illegally, because I'm Australian, so...
You're what?
I'm Australian.
So
I'd have to go back to Australia and...
You could work here.
Only illegally.
No, you could get...
Well, I can get a work permit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we just have to prove that time that the job should be given to me and not an EU citizen.
That's easy.
Yeah, I mean, it can be done. But yeah, going back to Australia is not an option. I don't fit with the scene there. So.
I have relatives in Australia.
Oh really? Which part?
I think it's close to Sydney.
Oh, that's where I'm
from.
I'm from Sydney.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's materially it's a very nice place. It's much better than being in England, but
she'll be right.
I'm not surrendered enough for the how things are there.
Yeah.
it's quite a different mood there in the temple, which doesn't really, I don't fit with.